Chapter 6 June. A recipe for making matches. Ingredients: 1 ounce powdered potassium nitrate, 1/2 an ounce minium, 1/2 an ounce powdered gum arabic, 1 dram phosphorus, saffron, cardboard. Preparation: the gum arabic is dissolved in enough hot water to form a paste that is not too thick. When the paste is ready, the phosphorus is added and dissolved into it, and the same is done with the potassium nitrate. Then enough minium is added to color the mixture. Tita was watching in silence as Dr. Brown completed these procedures. She was sitting by the window of the doctor's little laboratory in back of the patio behind his house. The light that filtered in through the window struck her shoulders and provided a faint sensation of warmth, so slight it was almost imperceptible. A chronic chill kept her from feeling warm, in spite of being covered with her heavy woolen bedspread. One of her greatest interests was still working on the bedspread each night, with yarn John had bought for her. Of the whole house, this was the place they both liked best. Tita had discovered it the week she arrived at Dr. Brown's. John, ignoring Mama Elena's order, had not put Tita in a madhouse, but had taken her to live with him. Tita would never be able to thank him enough. In a madhouse she might have become truly insane. But here, with John's warmth toward her in word and manner, she felt better each day. Her arrival there was like a dream. Among the blurry images, she remembered the terrible pain she felt when the doctor had set her broken nose. Afterward, John's large, loving hands had taken off her clothes and bathed her and carefully removed the pigeon droppings from her body, leaving her clean and sweet-smelling. Finally, he gently brushed her hair and put her in a bed with starched sheets. Those hands had rescued her from horror, and she would never forget it. Someday, when she felt like talking, she would tell John that, but now she preferred silence. There were many things she needed to work out in her mind, and she could not find the words to express the feelings seething inside her since she left the ranch. She was badly shaken. The first few days she didn't even want to leave her room. Her food was brought to her there by Katie, a 70-year-old North American woman, who, besides being in charge of the kitchen, also took care of Alex, the doctor's little boy, whose mother had died when he was born. Tita heard Alex laughing and running in the patio, but she felt no desire to meet him. Sometimes Tita didn't even taste her food, which was bland and didn't appeal to her. Instead of eating, she would stare at her hands for hours on end. She would regard them like a baby, marveling that they belonged to her. She could move them however she pleased, yet she didn't know what to do with them, other than knitting. She had never taken time to stop and think about these things. At her mother's, what she had to do with her hands was strictly determined, no questions asked. She had to get up, get dressed, get the fire going in the stove, fix breakfast, feed the animals, wash the dishes, make the beds, fix lunch, wash the dishes, iron the clothes, fix dinner, wash the dishes, day after day, year after year. Without pausing for a moment, without wondering if this was what she wanted. Now, seeing her hands no longer at her mother's command, she didn't know what to ask them to do. She had never decided for herself before. They could do anything or become anything. They could turn into birds and fly into the air. She would like them to carry her far away, as far as possible. Going to the window facing the patio, she raised her hands to heaven. She wanted to escape from herself, didn't want to think about making a choice, didn't want to talk again. She didn't want her words to shriek her pain. She yearned with all her soul to be borne off by her hands. She stood that way for a while, looking at the deep blue of the sky around her motionless hands. Tita thought the miracle was actually occurring, when she saw her fingers turning into a thin cloud rising to the sky. She prepared to ascend, drawn by a superior power, but nothing happened. Disappointed, she discovered that the smoke wasn't hers. It originated in a small room at the far end of the patio. Its chimney was emitting such a pleasant and familiar aroma that she opened the window to inhale it more deeply. Eyes closed, she saw herself beside Nacha on the kitchen floor making corn tortillas. She saw the pan where the most delicious casserole was cooking, and next to it, the beans just coming to a boil. Not even hesitating, she decided to go see who was cooking. It couldn't be Katie. The person who produced this kind of smell really knew how to cook. Never having laid eyes on her, Tita felt she knew this person, whoever she was. She strode across the patio and opened the door. There she met a pleasant woman around 80 years old. She looked a lot like Nacha. A thick braid was wound around her head, and she was wiping the sweat from her brow with her apron. Her features were plainly Indian. She was making tea in an earthenware pan. She looked up and smiled kindly, inviting Tita to sit down next to her. Tita did so. The woman immediately offered her a cup of the delicious tea. Tita sipped it slowly, drawing maximum pleasure from the aroma of the herbs, familiar and mysterious. How welcome its warmth and flavor! She stayed with the woman for a little while. The woman didn't speak either, but it wasn't necessary. From the first, they had established a communication that went far beyond words. From then on, Tita had visited her there every day. But gradually, Dr. Brown began to appear instead of the woman. The first time this happened, it had surprised her. She wasn't expecting to see him there, nor the changes he had made in the room's furnishings. Now the room contained many pieces of scientific equipment, test tubes, lamps, thermometers, and so on. The little stove no longer occupied a central place. It had been relegated to a tiny spot in the corner of the room. Moving it was not right, she felt, but since she did not want her lips to emit a single sound, she saved that opinion for later, as well as her question about the whereabouts and identity of the woman. Besides, she had to admit that she also enjoyed John's company a good deal. There was just one difference. He did speak to her as he worked, but instead of cooking, he was testing theories scientifically. He had inherited his fondness for experimentation from his grandmother, a Kickapoo Indian who John's grandfather had captured and brought back to live with him, far from her tribe. Despite this, and the fact that he married her, she was never accepted as his legal wife by the grandfather's proud, intensely Yankee family. So John's grandfather had built this room for her at the back of the house, where she could spend most of the day doing what interested her most, studying the curative properties of plants. The room also served as her refuge from the family's attacks. One of their first was to give her the nickname the Kickapoo, instead of calling her by her real name, thinking that this would really upset her. For the Browns, the word Kickapoo summed up everything that was most disagreeable in the world, but this was not at all the case with Morning Light. To her, it meant just the opposite, and was an enormous source of pride. That is but one small example of the huge difference in ideas and opinions that existed between the representatives of these two very different cultures, a gulf that made it impossible for the Browns to feel any desire to learn about the customs and traditions of Morning Light. Years passed before they began to discover a bit of the culture of the Kickapoo when John's great-grandfather, Peter, was very sick with a lung disease. His face was constantly purple from his fits of coughing. He wasn't getting enough air. His wife Mary knew something about medicine since her father was a doctor. She knew that in cases like his, the body of the sick person is producing too many red blood cells, so it is advisable to perform a bleeding to counter this imbalance and prevent this excess of blood cells from causing an infarction or a thrombosis, either of which can sometimes cause the death of the patient. So John's great-grandmother Mary started preparing some leeches for bleeding her husband. As she worked, she felt quite proud of herself for being up to date with the best scientific knowledge, which allowed her to protect her family's health using an appropriate modern method, not like the Kickapoo and her herbs. The leeches are placed inside a glass containing a half a finger of water and left there for an hour. The part of the body to which they will be applied is washed with lukewarm sugar water. Meanwhile, the leeches are placed in a clean handkerchief, which is folded over them. Then they are turned out onto the part of the body where they are to be attached, held down firmly with the handkerchief, and pressed into the skin so they don't pierce some other spot. To continue the bloodletting after the leeches have been removed, it helps to rub the skin with warm water. To control the bleeding and close the wounds, cover them with cloth or poplar bark, and then apply a poultice of breadcrumbs and milk, which is removed when the wounds have formed scabs. Mary followed all this to the letter, but when she pulled the leeches from Peter's arm, he started to lose blood and the hemorrhage couldn't be stopped. When the Kickapoo heard the desperate screams coming from the house, she ran to see what was happening. As soon as she went to the sick man and placed one of her hands on his wounds, the bleeding stopped. His family was absolutely astounded. Then she asked if they would please leave her alone with the sick man. After what they had just seen, no one dared to say no. She spent the entire afternoon at her father-in-law's bedside, singing strange melodies and applying curing herbs, wreathed in the smoke of the copal and incense she burned. It was well into night before the bedroom door opened and she came out, a cloud of incense surrounding her. Behind her appeared Peter, completely restored. After that, the Kickapoo was their family doctor. Within the North American community, she was widely accepted as a miracle healer. John's grandfather wanted to build a much larger room for her to carry on her investigations, but she didn't want one. In the whole house, she couldn't have a better place than her little laboratory. In her laboratory, John had passed most of his childhood and adolescence. He stopped visiting it when he entered the university because the modern medical theories he was learning there were in strong opposition to his grandmother's theories, to everything he had learned from her. As medical research progressed, John remembered his grandmother's teachings and the initiation she had given him in medicine. Now, after years of work and study, he had returned to her laboratory. He was convinced that only there would he find the most advanced medicine, if he could scientifically prove all the miracle cures Morning Light had accomplished. Tita loved to watch him work. With him, there were always things to learn and discover, like now, when he was making matches and conducting a class on phosphorus and its properties at the same time. Phosphorus was discovered in 1669 by Brandt, a Hamburg chemist who was looking for the Philosopher's Stone. He believed that metal could be transmuted into gold by mixing it with extract of urine. Using this method, he obtained a luminous substance that burned with an intensity such as had never been seen before. For a long time, phosphorus was obtained by vigorously heating the residue from evaporating urine in an earth retort, the neck of which was submerged in water. Today it is extracted from the bones of animals, which contain phosphoric acid and lime. Talking didn't make the doctor careless in his preparation of the matches. He had no trouble separating mental and physical activities. He could philosophize about even the most profound aspects of life without his hands pausing or making a mistake. While he was talking to Tita, he kept on making matches. Now that we have the phosphorus mixture, the next step is to prepare the cardboard for the matches. Dissolve a pound of potassium nitrate in a pound of water, stir in a little saffron to add color, and dip the cardboard in this solution. When it dries, cut the cardboard into narrow strips and place a little of the phosphorus mixture on the end of each strip. Allow the matches to dry, buried in sand. While the strips were drying, the doctor showed Tita an experiment. While phosphorus doesn't combine with oxygen to burn at ordinary temperatures, it does burst into flame very rapidly at an elevated temperature. Watch. The doctor placed a small amount of phosphorus in a tube that was closed at one end and full of mercury. He melted the phosphorus by holding the tube over the flame of a candle. Then, using a small bell jar containing oxygen, he transferred the gas to the jar very, very slowly. When the oxygen reached the top of the jar, where it encountered the melted phosphorus, an explosion occurred, brilliant, instantaneous, like a flash of lightning. As you see, within our bodies, each of us has the elements needed to produce phosphorus. And let me tell you something I've never told a soul. My grandmother had a very interesting theory. She said that each of us is born with a box of matches inside us, but we can't strike them all by ourselves. Just as in the experiment, we need oxygen and a candle to help. In this case, the oxygen, for example, would come from the breath of the person you love. The candle could be any kind of food, music, caress, word, or sound that engenders the explosion that lights one of the matches. For a moment we are dazzled by an intense emotion. A pleasant warmth grows within us, fading slowly as time goes by, until a new explosion comes along to revive it. Each person has to discover what will set off those explosions in order to live, since the combustion that occurs when one of them is ignited is what nourishes the soul. That fire, in short, is its food. If one doesn't find out in time what will set off these explosions, the box of matches dampens, and not a single match will ever be lighted. If that happens, the soul flees from the body and goes to wander among the deepest shades, trying in vain to find food to nourish itself, unaware that only the body it left behind, cold and defenseless, is capable of providing that food. How true these words were. Nobody knew it better than she. Unfortunately, she had to admit that her own matches were damp and moldy. No one would ever be able to light another one again. And the saddest thing was that she knew what set off her explosions, but each time she had managed to light a match, it had persistently been blown out. As if reading her thoughts, John went on, "That's why it's important to keep your distance from people who have frigid breath. Just their presence can put out the most intense fire, with results we're familiar with. If we stay a good distance away from those people, it's easier to protect ourselves from being extinguished." Taking one of Tita's hands in his, he added simply, "There are many ways to dry out a box of damp matches, but you can be sure there is a cure." Tita felt tears run down her face. Gently, John dried them with his handkerchief. "You must, of course, take care to light the matches one at a time. If a powerful emotion should ignite them all at once, they would produce a splendor so dazzling that it would illuminate far beyond what we can normally see, and then a brilliant tunnel would appear before our eyes, revealing the path we forgot the moment we were born, and summoning us to regain the divine origin we had lost. The soul ever longs to return to the place from which it came, leaving the body lifeless. Ever since my grandmother died, I have been trying to demonstrate this theory scientifically. Perhaps someday I will succeed. What do you think?" Dr. Brown remained silent to give Tita time to say something if she wished, but she was as silent as a stone. "Well, I mustn't bore you with my talk. Let's take a break. But before we go, I'd like to show you a game my grandmother and I used to play. We spent most of the day here, and she taught me her secrets through games. She was a quiet woman, just like you. Sitting in front of her stove, her heavy braid wrapped around her head, she was always able to read my thoughts. I wanted to learn how to do it, so after much begging, she gave me my first lesson. She would write a sentence on the wall using some invisible substance without my seeing. When I looked at the wall at night, I would find out what she had written. Do you want to try it? From what he'd said, Tita realized that the woman she'd sat with so often was John's dead grandmother. Now she didn't need to ask him. The doctor took a piece of phosphorus in a rag and gave it to Tita. I don't want to break the rule of silence you have imposed, so, as a secret between us, I'm going to ask you to write the reason you won't talk on that wall over there as soon as I leave, all right? Tomorrow I will divine the words before your eyes. What the doctor neglected to tell Tita, of course, was that one of the properties of phosphorus was that it would glow in the dark, revealing what she had written on the wall. He had no real need of this subterfuge to know what she was thinking, but he thought it would be a good way for Tita to start communicating with the world again, if only in writing. John could see she was ready. When the doctor left, Tita took the phosphorus and went up to the wall. That night, when John Brown entered the laboratory, he was pleased to see the writing on the wall in firm, phosphorescent letters, "Because I don't want to." With those words, Tita had taken her first step toward freedom. Meanwhile, she was staring up at the ceiling, unable to stop thinking of John's words. Was it possible for her soul to stir again? With her whole being, she wanted to believe that it was. She had to find someone who could kindle her desire. Could that someone be John? She was remembering the pleasant sensation that ran through her body when he took her hand in the laboratory. No, she wasn't sure. The only thing she was absolutely sure about was that she did not want to return to the ranch. She never wanted to live near Mama Elena again. To be continued. Next month's recipe. Oxtail soup.